Chapter 12. Moral Imagination. Darwinism and Ethics. Free spirits act out of their impulses, that is, from intuitions chosen by thinking from the totality of their world of ideas. The reason that unfree spirits separate particular intuitions from their world of ideas to make them the basis of an action lies in what the perceptual world has given them, that is, in their previous experiences. Before coming to a decision, unfree spirits remember what someone did or recommended or what God commanded in such a case and so forth. Then they act accordingly. Free spirits have other sources of action than these preconditions. They make absolutely original decisions. They worry neither about what others have done in their situation, nor about what they have been commanded to do. Purely conceptual reasons move them to select a particular concept from the sum of their concepts and translate it into action. Their action, however, belongs to perceptible reality. What they perform there will thus be identical to a quite specific perceptual content. The concept will have to realize itself in a concrete, individual event. But as a concept, it cannot contain that event. It can relate to it only as any concept relates to a percept, for example, as the concept of lion relates to an individual lion. The link mediating between a concept and a percept is the mental picture. For an unfree spirit, this link is given in advance. Motives are present in advance as mental pictures in consciousness. When unfree spirits want to do something, they do it as they have seen it done, or as they have been told to do in this particular case. Authority, therefore, works best through examples, that is, through the transmission of quite specific individual acts to the consciousness of unfree spirits. A Christian acts less in accordance with the teachings than with the model of the Redeemer. With regard to positive action, rules have less value than they do for the restraint of particular actions. Only when they forbid actions only when they forbid actions and not when they command them to be done, do laws take on universal conceptual form. Laws concerning what unfree spirits should do must be given to them in quite concrete form. Clean the street in front of your doorway. Pay your taxes at just this rate at tax office X, and so forth. The laws forbidding actions take the conceptual form, thou shalt not steal, thou shalt not commit adultery. But these laws, too, affect unfree spirits only by their appeal to concrete mental pictures, such as that of the corresponding secular punishment, torments of conscience, eternal damnation, and so forth. As soon as an impulse to action is present in the form of a general concept, for example, thou shalt do good to thy neighbor, or thou shalt live so as best to further any well-being. As soon as an impulse to action is present in the form of a general concept, for example, thou shalt do good to thy neighbor, or thou shalt live so as best to further thy well-being, then a concrete mental picture of the action, the relation of the concept to a perceptual content, must first be found in each individual case. This translation of concept into mental picture is always necessary for a free spirit, who is driven neither by a model nor by fear of punishment. Imagination is the chief means by which human beings produce concrete mental pictures from the sum of their ideas. Free spirits need moral imagination to realize their ideas and make them effective. Moral imagination is the source of a free spirit's actions. Therefore, only people who have moral imagination are really morally productive. Simple moral preachers, that is, people who spin out codes of ethics without being able to condense them into concrete mental pictures, are morally unproductive. They are like critics who can rationally discuss what works of art should be like, but cannot themselves produce anything at all. To turn a mental picture into a reality, moral imagination must set to work in a specific field of percepts. Human action does not create percepts. It recasts already existing percepts, then gives them a new form. To be able to transform a specific perceptual object or group of objects in accordance with a moral mental picture, one must have understood the laws of the perceptual picture to which one wants to give new form or new direction. That is, one must have understood how it has worked until now. Further, one must find the method by which those laws can be transformed. This part of moral efficacy depends on knowledge of the phenomenal world with which one is dealing. This knowledge must therefore be sought in a branch of general scientific knowledge. Hence, along with the faculty for moral ideas and imagination, moral action presupposes the capacity to transform the world of percepts without interrupting its coherence in natural law. Footnote: only a superficial view could see in the use of the word faculty here and in other passages a return to an older psychology's teaching of soul faculties. Connecting it with what was said on pages 88 and 89 yields the exact meaning of the word. End of footnote. The capacity to transform the world of percepts is moral technique. It is learnable in the sense that any knowledge is learnable. Generally, people are better equipped to find concepts for the world that is already finished than to determine productively out of their imagination future not yet existent actions. Therefore, those without moral imagination may well receive the moral mental pictures of other people and skillfully work them into reality. The reverse can also occur. People with moral imagination can lack technical skill and may have to make use of others to realize their mental pictures. Insofar as knowledge of the objects within our field of action is necessary for moral action, our actions are based upon this kind of knowledge. What is relevant here are natural laws. We are dealing with natural science, not with ethics. Moral imagination and the moral capacity for ideas can become objects of knowledge only after an individual has produced them. By then they no longer regulate life, they have already regulated it. They can be regarded as effective causes, like any others. They are purposes only for the subject. Hence we deal with them as with a natural history of moral ideas. Apart from this, there can be no science of ethical norms. Some people have tried to retain the normative character of moral laws, at least to the extent that they have understood ethics as if it were analogous to dietetics. Dietetics derives general rules from the organism's requirements for life, so as then to affect the body on the basis of these rules. Footnote: C.F. Paulsen, System der Ethik, System of Ethics, 1889. Friedrich Paulsen was a German philosopher, educator, and professor who elaborated a theory of panpsychism and wrote on Kant in the History of German Education. End of footnote. But the comparison between ethics and dietetics is false, because our moral life cannot be compared with the life of the organism. The organism's activity exists without any contribution on our part. We find its laws already present in the world. Hence, we can seek the laws and apply those that we have found. But moral laws are first created by us. Before they are created, we cannot apply them. The error arises because moral laws are not created at each moment with a new content, but are inherited. Thus, moral laws inherited from one's ancestors appear to be given, like the natural laws of the organism, but they are in no way applied by a later generation with the same legitimacy as the rules of diet. For moral laws deal with the individual, and not, like natural law, with an example of a species. I, as an organism, am just such an example of a species. I will live according to nature if I apply the natural laws of the species to my particular case. But as a moral being, I am an individual and have laws of my very own. Footnote: when Paulsen says, quote, different natural predispositions and life conditions require both a different corporeal diet and a different spiritual moral diet, unquote, he is quite close to the right understanding, yet he misses the decisive point. To the extent that I am an individual, I do not need a diet. Dietetics is the art of bringing the particular example into harmony with general laws. But as an individual, I am not an example of a species. And footnote.